Any baby's first steps are a very big deal. Learning to walk makes us part of who we are. And that connection goes a lot deeper than we think. Locomotion shapes us as creatures on the earth, so says our guest this hour. How we get from place to place has a great deal to do with how we got the kinds of bodies we now sport. Look at fish and mammals in the ocean, pretty much built the same way because they move the same way. This is the stuff of the book Restless Creatures, the story of life in 10 movements by Matt Wilkinson, who's a biologist and a science writer currently employed in the Department of Zoology at the University of Cambridge in the UK. Matt Wilkinson, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thanks very much, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be here.
So the view of evolution from scientists, do many believe that evolution would unfold differently, done again? It really is that random?
Yeah. So this is very much Stephen Jay Gould's idea. So, you know, the great evolutionary biologist, Stephen Jay Gould, who made this analogy that if we reran the tape of evolution, we'd get something completely different, a world completely alien to the one we know now. There are others who think rather differently, and I think I'd count myself a lot among those, that you know, the physical constraints, the physical realities that creatures have to contend with, particularly in terms of how they move around, actually determine to a very large extent the range of shapes that they're able to adopt.
So how we move essentially made us what we are.
Yes, I'd completely agree with that, yes.
There's a great quote in here early in the book. You said, pterodactyls showed me the light. What was the light and how did they show you?
Right, yeah, so pterodactyls, that was what I worked on when I was a wee PhD student many years ago. So I was coming to this problem. I just finished my first degree and I was thinking, okay, well, what do I want to do? What do I want to find out about? And pterodactyls, they sort of inspired me. They're this wonderful denizens of a lost world. And I thought, okay, well, why not try and find out exactly how they flew? And it struck me that flight was actually brilliant from this perspective because it's such a difficult thing to do. You know, the fossil record is obviously quite imperfect. We only have sort of fragmentary fossils here and there. But the demands of flight are so strict, so severe, that I felt that, you know, as long as you bear these constraints in mind, you know something about how aerodynamics works, then that will help you kind of reanimate these fossils. It will help you kind of work out how they lived. So that was really the sort of starting point for the whole thing. And then as time went on, as I learned more and more about the pterodactyls and how they flew, I guess it sort of trained me to look at the world in a different way, to see creatures as physical mechanisms, as machines that are having to kind of contend with this physical reality. And it struck me that this was an enormously powerful way of looking at the world because it gives you this wonderful understanding. If you kind of understand how things are able to move, suddenly the natural world started falling into focus or started falling into place. And I was sort of looking at all these things and thinking, all right, I kind of get you now. I sort of understand why you're the way you are. So the book was very much my wish to share that view with the readers.
And where it goes with pterodactyls is pretty easy to follow because they're not like birds or bats, and yet all three of those creatures, when they were alive, found ways to get themselves airborne through similar but not completely identical structures.
Yeah. And that's interesting that you do get, you know, the convergent evolution, the fact that they've all ended up looking somewhat similar is quite striking, but so also are the differences. And that's my other major strand, I guess, is that these differences are caused by where they were when they started out, where they were when they started to learn how to fly, to evolve how to fly. So that's kind of given us these, you know, the differences between a bat wing, which is supported by skin, which is a supported array of skin, and then the bird wing, which is supported by feathers. So it's you do get these wonderful differences, which I kind of keep the drama alive, I guess, with the whole evolutionary story.
Indeed, you do. But there's another observation here by another scientist that sort of gives us a place to pause early in the book, and it's Ernest Rutherford's rather dismissive quote that the only true science is physics. And what did he say is the rest?
Stamp collecting, yes. Thanks, Ernest.
Truly. But in a sense, you're agreeing with that because physics and motion are what led to how we became the creatures we are, is what you're saying.
I kind of, I wouldn't. I would never call it
not stamp collecting.
Yeah, but I think, you know, it makes the point that you really do need to treat organisms as physical entities. to really understand why they are as they are. And then once you get that, I think it's this enormously powerful way of looking at the world.
Are there some general rules that apply widely, like that we evolved to reproduce, or we evolved to reach food, or we evolved to run away from things that wanted to turn us into food?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And I think this is why locomotion has been so important, why natural selection seems to be so concerned about it, if I may personify natural selection for once. So we all need to find food. We all need to find fuel. And even if all of that is readily available in one place, our offspring still had to disperse away from us. We still had to kind of get male and female together. So motion does tend to enjoy this really high priority in the eyes of natural selection.
All right, much more to talk about with Matt Wilkinson. His book is Restless Creatures, The Story of Life in 10 Movements, in which we learn about the ways in which how we get from place to place really shaped the creatures on the earth, us included in a very big way. And in fact, humans are chapter one. So we'll come back and talk about that after a short break. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone and by email at jx@jeffnet.org. Back with Matt Wilkinson and Restless Creatures and you in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dr. Matt Wilkinson. He is a biologist and science writer currently employed in the Department of Zoology at the University of Cambridge in the UK. He's written a book about how we move, turning us into what we are, essentially. Restless Creatures, The Story of Life in 10 Movements, which makes the case that how we get from place to place ultimately, over many, 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 many years and centuries, turns us into the creatures we are. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by email jx@jeffnet.org. So chapter one is about us humans. In a sense, does our ease of locomotion, Matt, defy physics?
I wouldn't say it defies physics. It certainly challenges us. It defies what we've been able to do in terms of our design of robots, for instance. Things like the Asimo is quite a famous Japanese walking robot. It's very sophisticated and a fantastic piece of technology, but it uses 10 times the amount of energy that we do as it walks to place to place. So what we can do is astonishingly cheap and elegant by comparison.
I had a feeling when we started talking about motion that we'd run into Edward Muybridge, and mm-hmm. Here he is in the book. So what did he do for our knowledge of motion?
Yes, he was the one who first really enabled us to see it properly. I mean, it's just one of these odd paradoxes, really, that we're also used to seeing things move, that we kind of take this for granted. But if you really want to try and analyze how something is doing this, it suddenly becomes really difficult because even for fairly slow movers, there are all sorts of little things happening just so rapidly that we simply can't take it in. We can't we can't dissect what's going on. So Muybridge invented this wonderful technique of essentially letting a moving animal, or indeed a moving human, photograph itself. To take this series of rapid freeze-frame photographs. So we suddenly had access to all the details of movement. Essentially what he did was slow down time, I guess. So finally we could work out what an animal was actually doing to propel itself from place to place.
Which was most significant, I guess, at first with horses, because he was the person who could say definitively through his photographs, yes, all four horses' hooves do get off the ground, which I understand really displeased a couple of sculptors.
Yes. Yeah, well, there's a French portrait painter in particular, sort of Anton Meissonier, and he'd kind of made a name for himself sort of painting horses, and it turned out that he'd just been getting the posture wrong. He's so Muybridge, when he first made this demonstration in Paris, I gather Meissonier was rather put out when he saw that he'd just got it all wrong.
The collections of Muybridge's work are probably really well known. I mean, even if you don't know the name, you probably have seen the sequences of pictures of horses and people with clothes on and people naked and all sorts of different things. But it really gave us a chance to look at how motion worked. And then you bring up the Frenchman, Etienne Jules Marais, who built on Muybridge's work. What did he do?
Yeah, so he came from a very different angle. So Muybridge was always a photographer. That was his calling. And was really very much interested in the aesthetic dimension, I guess, of human animal movement. Whereas Marais was a physiologist, and he was kind of really interested in how it worked. So he'd already come up with a few techniques, so fitting air-filled chambers onto runners' shoes to try and kind of measure what was going on by puffs of air and all sorts of things. He was a fantastic inventor. But he'd always had this sticking point that he didn't have that photographic, he didn't have that visual way of seeing what's going on. So then when he saw Muybridge's first publications of his photographs, he realized that, this is exactly what he'd been looking for, this technique. So now he struck up a correspondence with him, and actually the two became quite close friends, and they collaborated quite significantly over the years.
Science is still doing some of this work, obviously, with more advanced tools. That was brought to mind from reading your book of the studies a couple of years ago. I think it was with fruit flies, where they figured out the efficiency in the wings because of some elasticity that allowed the rebounding of the wing into the original position easier. Does that sound familiar to you?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that specific study, but certainly I know of a lot of other very similar things. A lot of it doing these sort of fantastic model work, actually. So things have been able to replicate the insect wing beat in every detail. And we can see now, we can analyze the flow of the air over their wings and see exactly what those wings are doing to the fluid around them. So no, the science has come on tremendously. But no, it's worth pointing out that in many cases, we're still essentially using those same techniques dreamed up by Muybridge and Marais. I mean, it's much more sophisticated now, but they really were the true pioneers of this field.
One of the things, as you pointed out, you were talking about the efficiency of walking, particularly when you compare us with robots. I mean, how energy efficient are we when we walk?
Oh, dear, you put me on the spot now.
I don't need to know exact numbers of joules. Yeah,
so I'm afraid I don't have the values to hand. I do apologize. I'm always thinking more in relative terms.
But the fact is the general point being that we don't expend a great deal of energy for a variety of reasons and the mechanisms that we use to work.
Yeah, so we can see this in if we measure the muscle contractions actually during walking movements. The very few of our muscles are even our leg muscles. They're kind of not doing anything at all. It's all just natural swings. Our legs are acting very much like pendulums. There's a little bit of muscle contraction here and there, just to kind of keep us on an even keel and make sure we're kind of to make up for losses due to friction and that kind of thing. But yeah, it's really quite astonishing how little work we're doing as we're walking.
Matt Wilkinson is the author of Restless Creatures, the story of life in 10 movements, about how the way we use locomotion shapes the creatures we are on the earth. You go into a fairly tight focus on the windlass mechanism of the foot. What is that?
Yeah, so this is one of our magnificent sort of energy-saving features. It's that the foot... it's one of these things that's so easily taken for granted, but it's a very, very complicated object. There are about 26 bones there, and it's a fantastic spider web of ligaments and tendons. And it's got to do three different jobs throughout a step. So it's got to absorb the impact of landing. It's then got to mold to the ground so that we have a nice, stable platform to move over, but then turn into a rigid lever to give us a nice, efficient push-off. And these extraordinary things happen within the foot throughout the step to enable that change of function. The most important one being, it's called the windlass mechanism because of the ancient technique of using a crank-operated drum to lift very heavy loads. So we all have this fan of tissue running across the sole of our foot. That becomes very tight as we start to lift the foot up. So as we sort of bend the toes back, that bit of tissue becomes very tight. It pulls the heel forwards, and then that locks the bones of the foot into place. So that then converts what had been quite a squishy foot into something much more rigid, so we get nice leverage as we push off.
So while we're walking, the foot is going soft, hard, soft, hard, soft, hard.
Exactly, yeah.
Wow, okay, so... Let's talk about the differences in the sequence of what goes on in the foot and leg muscles in running as opposed to walking. This is a very different thing, isn't it?
Yes, they are. I mean, interesting, if you look at the profile of the muscle contractions, actually not that much is different, aside from an overall increase in the level of activity, as you'd expect. And there's really only kind of one major change, and that is the timing of activation of the calf muscles. So when we're walking, the calf muscles just give a little twitch right at the end of the step to push the foot off, whereas in running, they contract prematurely. And the idea there is that it's helping us to spring load the Achilles tendon, which is the tendon that runs from the back of the heel to the leg. And that allows us to save a bit of energy. It's storing energy in the impact of landing, that as we then spring back off again, it's returning that energy to us in the form of kinetic energy. So it's one of our many energy-saving features that we see in our legs and feet.
Well, there's a really great question that you pose in your own book, which is if speed is important, if you're trying to catch food or not become food, why are we on two legs instead of on four?
Yeah. So this is one of the questions I pose early on in the book, because I feel it's one that propels us back into our evolutionary history, because it's only by taking that into account that we can explain this. Yeah, so by walking on two legs, we essentially are cutting off galloping. We can't gallop anymore. Well, we can, but we can only do it on two legs when we skip, and that's actually not very effective. If you're four-legged, that galloping allows you to really increase the stride length. So cheetahs famously can go at about 60 miles per hour. So, yeah, it's very strange that we've ended up walking on two legs. And it only really makes sense if you bear our ancestry in the trees in mind. Now, particularly our past as quite large-bodied apes, because they, monkeys who came before apes, they generally scamper around on four legs in the trees, whereas apes, when they started getting big, that started becoming a little bit unsafe. So what they did was then essentially just kind of tilt themselves backwards so that the spine was much more vertical. And you can see this in all the apes today. So gibbons, orangutans, gorillas, chimpanzees, when they're in the trees, they all tend to orient their spine vertically. And that was really the starting point then for a number of different specializations that we saw within that group. But in our own ancestors, we came down out of the trees, and that meant that we were kind of prepared, essentially, to walk on two legs on the ground. So it was because of the change in locomotion in the trees that we ended up turning our back on four-legged locomotion and ended up becoming two-legged.
Is it clear from the fossils of predecessor species to humans that we can tell when we began to walk erect?
That's always been quite a bone of contention, if you'll pardon me.
Fossils bones, yeah.
Unintended. So there's a lot of controversy over this. There are some who think that the ancestor we share with chimpanzees was essentially like a chimpanzee, a sort of four-legged, well, maybe able to walk on two legs a little bit, but mostly a four-legged thing. Personally, and I'm not alone here, but I think that move to two-leggedness probably happened somewhat earlier than that. And actually what we see in chimpanzees is more of a specialization in chimpanzees. And I think there's really one fossil which is pushing us towards that picture, and this is this wonderful thing called Ardi, the Ardipithecus ramidus. It's a 4.5 million-year-old creature that was found in Kenya. And yes, it shows it doesn't really have the specializations that we see in chimps for hanging from its arms. Its hands are proportioned much more like humans, and actually much more like the very earliest extinct apes as well. Its pelvis is much more like ours. And it seems that what chimpanzees are doing is really quite specialized. And our last common ancestor arguably was probably able to walk on two legs quite well.
We are talking with Matt Wilkinson, who is a British biologist and science writer. He's written a book called Restless Creatures, The Story of Life in 10 Movements, which is essentially about his theory that how we get from place to place really shapes what we look like as species on the Earth. Think about the fact that there are creatures in the ocean that are both mammals and, well, there are mammals and there are fish in the oceans, shaped similarly because they travel similarly. Jeannie in Medford looks like she's about to take us to science class. Welcome, Jeannie.
Oh, hi. I'm always fascinated how mathematics just seems to show up everywhere in music and particularly in locomotion. I asked my boss once to explain Laplace's equation. He said, "You see that seagull over there getting ready to fly? And when the seagull took off in flew, he goes, that's Laplace's equation."
Really?
And I'm just thinking with prosthetics now and locomotion, and I'll listen. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for that. Appreciate it, Jeannie. Are you familiar with Laplace's equation?
We might be thinking of a different Laplace's equation. The one I know is about pressurized bubbles and cylinders and things. It's wonderful. It's, it's one of these really simple little equations which explains all sorts of things, like how plants can drag water right up to the tops of even giant redwoods can get water right up to the tips of their trunks. It's it's one of these wonderful laws that you can see everywhere.
Or maybe she's got the Bernoulli principle in mind then, which gets us into flight, which is the next section of the book anyway. Mm-hmm. You break our hearts as we get into flight because no primates can even glide. Is that right?
Sorry, say that again.
No primates can even glide?
Yeah, this is true. It's one of these really strange aspects of our group because if you look, primates, our group, they're well known for living in the trees. They do really well in the trees. That's their home environment. And for most groups that live in that environment, you would expect to see some gliders. So we see gliding squirrels have evolved many, many times. There are a lot of things we call gliding squirrels, which actually belong to other groups. So you've got marsupial versions as well. You've got gliding snakes. You've got gliding lizards. You've got gliding frogs. And yet no gliding primates. So it's something of a tragedy because we're we're barred from flight. But what I suggest is that this is actually it's a consequence of the way primates move in the trees, which in itself ended up opening the door to the human-style bipedal locomotion, and particularly to the opposable thumbs, because this ability to wrap your hand around a branch means that primates do very well on these very narrow branches, and that's just simply not a very good environment for starting out as a glider. Partly because it's going to make it very difficult to land. Obviously, if you're thinking of a glider needing to stretch its limbs out, suddenly faced with a very narrow branch, it's got a problem. But also, if you're able to scamper around on the tips of the tree canopy, it's then much, much easier for you to just hop from canopy to canopy, and you then don't need to bother about gliding underneath it. So it seems that, this opposable thumb, by enabling us to clamber on these little fine branches, was actually something of a mixed blessing because it ended up kind of depriving us of the joys of flight.
Right, but at least we can pick up our phones.
True.
And grip them. And read books, for that matter. We can flip the pages.
Good thing
for those thumbs. You force us to think in the book, though, about the difference between gliding and flying, starting from above in the trees versus below on the ground. Is there still something of a debate in biology, a fairly heated one perhaps, about where flying began?
Yeah, it certainly is, particularly where the birds are concerned, because it's now, I wouldn't say, it's not quite universally accepted, but very almost universally accepted, that birds evolved from dinosaurs, from fast-running, two-legged predatory dinosaurs. And, of course, this is then a bit of a problem because these are not obvious gliders. Now, we seem to be faced with terrestrial specialists. These things are specialized for running around on the ground. And so, the idea developed that, maybe bird flight evolved from the ground up. So, evolving flapping directly rather than how most of us think, say, bats evolve flight by, starting off a bit like a flying squirrel as a glider and then gradually perfecting that and becoming a powered flyer via a gliding stage. And, there has been, quite a to and fro over the years. Some very significant fossil finds lately seem, certainly in my view, to be favoring more the trees down view. We found this beautiful fossil, Microraptor. It's a fairly small dinosaur. It's feathered. Its feathers are preserved. And it's got flight feathers both on its arms and on its legs. And that's kind of the key, the fact that it's got these long feathers on its legs. Because it seems that would probably have made moving on the ground quite difficult. The theory that I'm pushing is that what happened is that one group of dinosaurs essentially became tree climbers and developed four wings that we see in the Microraptor, and that it's from that stage, and they were probably gliders, that they then developed the powers of flapping flight.
Four wings? So, yeah. But for gliding, not for flapping independently?
Yes, yes, yes. Yes, it seems quite unlikely that they would have flapped, certainly their legs during flight.
Yeah, sounds a little busy and certainly energy-consuming. Matt Wilkinson's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Restless Creatures, The Story of Life in 10 Movements. We're talking about creatures and how they move and how their locomotion probably shaped them evolutionarily through the eons. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and take your questions and comments if you have some. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Matt Wilkinson, Restless Creatures, and you in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dr. Matt Wilkinson, a zoologist, or rather biologist and science writer at the Department of Zoology at the University of Cambridge in the UK. He's the author of a book called Restless Creatures, The Story of Life in 10 Movements, about how we move pretty much determines what we end up looking like through evolutionary time. Think about the ways in which we travel and how it is affected by our bodies or vice versa. 800-838-3760 if you have some stories to swap, some questions to ask, or some comments to make. 800-838-3760 by phone or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning.
Hi.
I have heard that the only method of moving a single human being that's more efficient than walking, energy efficient than walking, is riding a derailleured bicycle, you know, multiple speed bicycle. And I'm wondering if you're able to, you know, confirm or refute that.
Okay, the focus seems to be more on living things, but we'll give him a crack at that. What do you say, Matt?
Well, I'd certainly say that riding on a bicycle in most cases would be much more efficient than walking. I can't comment on this particular model, I'm afraid. But I'm really glad you brought that up, actually, because this raises a very interesting question about why we don't see wheels more often in the natural world. Because they do. Now, we make terrific use of them. Now, if you're riding downhill, you don't have to expend any energy at all, and you can go very, very far indeed. Yes, it's one of these fantastic questions. There are all sorts of answers to. I mean, you could suggest that in terms of the gradual evolution, we've got a problem, because what use is half a wheel? but we've also got this fundamental problem of biological organization, that biological entities require continuity, physical spatial continuity.
Yeah, how do you keep your blood vessels from not getting twisted together if you have a wheel?
Exactly, yes. If the axle is separate from the wheel, you've got a really real problem. How are you going to grow and keep that wheel nourished? So it's that's an interesting one.
Another question from Jim in Grants Pass. He just dropped off a very short question about kangaroo locomotion and how we explain that.
Yeah, so kangaroos. The studies have shown that actually once they're hopping away, they can increase their speed without any increase in metabolic energy expenditure. It's really that efficient. And it's all thanks to their Achilles tendon. So, like us, they have an Achilles tendon, which runs from their calf muscles to the heel. Their feet are obviously much longer than ours. Their hind legs are rather better developed than ours. But it's such an effective energy storage system that, yeah, they can effectively increase speed. I mean, I'm sure eventually they're going to hit a wall. But, yeah, they can travel fantastically efficiently using those that hopping motion.
Wow, they're like momentum machines.
They really
do keep that going. Here's another call from Al in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Matt Wilkinson.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. You know, I have maybe 20 years ago, I read a book by a psychologist named Robert Ernstein, who was at Stanford. And he proposes this idea, or maybe somebody else's, but the idea that humans stood up is because of 9 million years ago, there was some volcanic activity around in eastern Africa, and that resulted in whatever east of the mountains become, the trees became sparse, and our ancestors had to walk between these trees, which resulted in them they haven't stand up because of the heat of the ground. I would like to know if you have any comment about that.
There is a very reference to that in the book, Matt.
Mm-hmm. This is another classic theory for why we became two-legged, is that the trees in which our ancestors had been dwelling started to thin out. It may not just have been because of volcanic eruptions. The climate was changing then. The climate was becoming much drier, sort of much more seasonal, I guess. Basically, the thing that sort of moved us away from that thinking is really just the nature of the fossil evidence that we've, now, as we start to look, particularly actually of Lucy, so the famous Lucy, Australopithecus afarensis, mm-hmm. that was discovered back in the 70s, 3.2 million years old. She could walk very well on two legs. She was certainly nothing like a kind of quadrupedal movement. She'd clearly been, we're looking at a culmination of quite a long period of time of walking on two legs. But if you look at the fossils that she is found with, we're looking at woodland animals. We seem to be looking at a woodland environment. So it seems, just by that bit of evidence alone, it's just really quite nice direct evidence that the move from four-legged to two-legged must have happened in a forested environment. And that it's not to say that thinning out of the forest wasn't significant, because I think what happened after this point is, the savannas started to grow, and that's when we essentially got really good at two-legged locomotion. So, Lucy, pretty good walker. She's not a very good runner, whereas if you look at our ancestors, particularly once you start to get to our own Homo genus, so this is Homo erectus and Homo ergaster, where we have much longer legs, somewhat shorter arms, really very good, particularly at endurance running. So that move into the savannah was significant, but it almost certainly was not the original impetus for the move to two-leggedness.
Well, that's a really interesting thing to bring up, though, that we're really built for the marathons and not for the sprints,
yeah.
It sounds like.
Yes. It's then this is based on a lot of really good work recently, particularly by people like Dan Lieberman at Harvard, that there are lots of aspects of our anatomy which kind of help us be good endurance runners. Interestingly, not all of them are necessarily about the direct physics of propulsion. There's another subset of this, which is actually as much about thermoregulation. It's about control of temperature.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, this is one of the big problems. If you're running over the savannah for hours on end, you're going to run the risk of getting really hot, overheating, and keeling over. This has been suggested that one of the reasons we became hairless and why we are unusually sweaty, right? It's kind of connected with this whole thing, that it's to do with this endurance running lifestyle, which many believe is how we originally caught our food, our living prey. Is when we started to become more like this that we started eating a lot more meat in our diet. And you can tell that from isotopes in the fossils and that sort of thing. That we essentially were able, because we got a much better coolant system, to run our antelope prey to exhaustion, even though now on paper, these things can gallop. they should be able to beat us. But they're the ones that end up dying of exhaustion because they don't have the really effective coolant system that comes with being a two-legged runner.
Having some fur on them as well.
Yeah.
Let's take another call from Michael in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Matt Wilkinson, the author of Restless Creatures.
Hello, this is Michael. I'm wondering about the feathers were already evolving in bipedal dinosaurs, mm-hmm. To maintain bodily warmth. If the males of bipedal dinosaurs would engage in mating competition with one another as fowl do today, jumping and fighting one another, if you have the ability to maintain a height advantage, the feathers you may have evolved for bodily warmth that could help you stay up a bit longer and increase your breeding potential. And I just wonder if that may have led to flight. I've never heard anyone mention that, but
mm-hmm.
I'll take your comments off air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for that, Michael. Appreciate it.
Yes, this is actually a leading theory for how bird wings, at least, started to grow. So it's absolutely right. When we first see feathers, they're probably rather like fur, actually, or down, downy feathers. They're used for insulation more than anything else. Then we begin to see, so we see this in the fossil record, we can see they start to develop these stubby wings. And the prevailing opinion at the moment is that that development was probably fueled more by sexual selection. So these were being used for display, perhaps, indeed, to signal for mates, all of that sort of thing. So, and actually, there's some really nice evidence from another Microraptor fossil, where we can actually see the microstructure of the feathers. We can see these little particles that are in regular stacks, and we know of such structures in modern bird feathers. And it's what gives those feathers an iridescent sheen. And we know that the iridescence of feathers does play a role in sexual selection. So now that's actually a really quite solid theory. However, in terms of the origin of flight, obviously you do need wings, but wings alone, if you're on the ground, are not going to be enough. You're going to have to flap them. And this is one of the big problems I have with the ground-up theory, is how evolution is going to favor the development of the flight stroke in that terrestrial setting, because until you are really good at it, it's a complicated thing to do, and it takes an awful lot of energy, and you have to be really, really good at it before you get any benefit from them at all. And in that intervening period, you're just wearing yourself out. You're wasting energy. So I still think we're going to need to have them in the trees at some point, even though they may already have some stubby wings when they went up there. But it's only in that context that really that they're going to be able to develop as useful aerodynamic structures.
Trees down, not ground up.
Yeah.
Let's go swimming. We had the motion mechanics of fish wrong for a very long time. There's some great stories here, including one involving Etienne Jules Marais again. What did he do?
Yeah, so again, Marais, you know, wonderful man there. He invented this technique for filming fish in such the way that we could really see what was going on with how they're moving in the water. And until that point, the prevailing theory had been that fish swim by using their tail as an oar, essentially. So when you use an oar, you need a power stroke and a recovery stroke. What people thought about fish is that, therefore they must be doing something to the tail, such that the beat to the left might be a little bit different from the beat to the right and that sort of thing. And Marais kind of put pay to that theory once and for all, that it seems that the beat of the tail from side to side is completely symmetrical. So actually they're not using their tail as an oar at all. And that's it's a fair bit more complicated than this, that they're using the side-to-side movements of their tail, or indeed their whole body if you're looking at something like an eel, to draw water and fling it backwards. So they're essentially kind of sucking water and then flinging it backwards. And by throwing that water backwards, by Newton's third law, the fish body ends up being propelled forwards.
The equal and opposite reaction?
Exactly, yes, thank you.
I love some of these stories here, like the guy who added milk to water. What was he able to figure out through that?
This is Mo William Rosen, who's an American engineer. I think it was a master's project, actually. So he added water to a layer of milk in order to look at the wake behind a swimming fish, and the idea being that as the fish swam along, it disturbs the interface between the milk and the water. And it gave us a very beautiful picture of this series of whirling eddies, the vortices behind a fish's tail. We're now able to analyze that in a lot more detail. So George Lauder, particularly at Harvard, invented this technique using lasers to illuminate these tiny little particles that have been added to the water. So we're able to reconstruct the wake behind a fish in a great amount of detail now. So now we know an awful lot about how fish can swim now.
Creatures in the water, I think, probably make the best case for your overall theory in restless creatures because, for example, you have sharks and dolphins, which look a lot alike, are shaped a lot alike, move a lot alike, but are not the same species, not even close.
Yeah, exactly. So I think in this case, what we're seeing is that the dominant influence of drag. Now, if you're swimming in the water, because water is so dense, drag is a big problem. So we see in most of the things which have, particularly those that have to swim pretty fast in the water, they need to be streamlined. They develop that torpedo shape. But with a sort of widened or deepened tail fin, just so they're able to take as much mass of water as possible and throw it into the wake, as well as a few stabilizing fins for maneuverability. So we're seeing that pattern crop up again and again and again. So, yes, you're absolutely right. It makes the point really very nicely that the demands of locomotion can have a really strong impact over the form that an animal takes.
So if animals had developed all these body structures that enabled them to move well in water, then the question becomes, why then head for land, where the moving certainly at first was going to be a whole lot harder?
Yes, yes. I think it's one of the, no, the really, it's again, one of these things we sort of take for granted, that the vertebrates, the backboned animals, ended up moving onto land. But it really is absolutely extraordinary that something that is, it seems so specialized for movement underwater, ends up being able to move on land. And it's a long, convoluted history. But no, just to kind of throw a couple of way stations in there, it seems that, I mean, one of the key things is turning your fins into limbs, which essentially means getting rid of that flimsy fin ray and developing the skeleton of the fin to be rather more robust. And fossil evidence has shown that this actually happened underwater. So we have this fantastic fossil called Acanthostega, found in Greenland, although at the time it was an equatorial river basin.
Wow.
And it was fully aquatic. It has gills. It has fin rays on its tail. It was certainly never, very unlikely that it ever moved on land. And we see it has already developed limbs. So that all-important transition happened underwater.
Wow.
I would suggest possibly because they're becoming ambush predators. Ambush predators, if you're kind of pushing off from a riverbed or a seabed, it means you're going to be a lot more sneaky, a lot more stealthy in your approach.
Huh. And here again, the ways in which we move determine ultimately what we end up being is the major case made in Matt Wilkinson's book, Restless Creatures, The Story of Life in 10 Movements. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you, Jeff. It's been a real pleasure.